Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Institute for Government. My name is Hannah White. I'm director of the IFG and the chair of the Commission on the Centre of Government, and I'm delighted to be launching the report here today. Thank you to everyone who's joined us here in the room and those who are joining us online. Thank you also to the Charities Aid Foundation for their grant of support for the Commission and for this launch event. We'll be live tweeting from the hashtag IFGCentre, so please do follow and tweet along. I'm delighted to be joined on stage by Sir Anthony Seldon, observer and biographer of every Prime Minister over the last 50 years and Deputy Chair of the Commission. And I'm also very pleased to see in the audience so many of the commissioners who are a vital part of this piece of work we've been conducting for the last year. Now, a little over a year ago, Anthony and I sat on this stage to launch the Commission on the Centre of Government. We talked about the strengths of Number 10, the Cabinet Office and the Treasury, but also the ways in which we think the central institutions of our state are broken. Too often, they let down the prime ministers they are designed to serve. Since then, the Commission has undertaken an intense year of research to delve into the problems that we see at the centre of government and to identify solutions. We've spoken to former prime ministers and cabinet secretaries, scientists and charity leaders, private sector executives and academic experts, governments around the world and across the UK. The work has been absolutely fascinating and very enjoyable. But one of the dispiriting themes has been that almost everybody we've spoken to thinks that in one way or another, the centre doesn't work. The centre is insufficiently strategic. Number 10 and the Cabinet Office suffer from confused remits and are underpowered in parts. And the strategic vacuum at the centre is left for the powerful Treasury to fill. Nobody defends the status quo. And it's striking to us that some of the strongest critics and those who back the most radical reforms are those who have worked in government most recently, or indeed who still work there. So in this report, we have not shied away from being radical. Our reforms involve substantial change, but we think that change is needed. It would lead to more effective government, better able to set a vision for the country, to work well beyond Whitehall, and to be capable of supporting prime ministers, and most importantly, rising to the challenges we face in the years ahead to deliver positive outcomes for citizens. We know that not everybody will agree. Indeed, one of the reasons we wanted to gather this eminent group here today is to launch a debate about the ideas we have to put forward. And we're confident that that debate will start today. But we're also confident that everybody here and everybody who reads our report will come away convinced that we do need change and that the coming election is the point to make it happen. I'm thrilled that Sir John Major and Gordon Brown, two eminent statesmen with deep experience of the centre, both as Chancellor and Prime Minister, have joined us today. In a moment, they'll offer their reflections on the centre and on the findings of the Commission. And then we'll move straight into a discussion of the Commission's conclusions with Baroness Louise Casey and Lord Gus O'Donnell. And then there'll be an opportunity also for questions from the floor. But before that, we have a short film to introduce the Commission's findings and key proposals.
As you walk down Whitehall, you pass the Cabinet Office, Downing Street, the Treasury. It's from these departments, these offices, that the centre of British government operates. It's from here that the Prime Minister directs the nation.
Facing huge challenges, stagnant economic growth, huge technological change, crumbling infrastructure, failing public services, an ageing population, climate change, and global instability. We need a centre that can enable the UK to meet these challenges. Successive prime ministers have discovered that problems at the centre have inhibited their ability to deliver on their priorities. The centre of government isn't fit to meet the challenges that face the UK in the 21st century.
So that's why, a year ago, the Institute for Government and I set up the Commission on the Centre to examine the problems at the very centre of British government and to make recommendations. Over the last year, we have spoken to those who've worked at the heart of Downing Street, for the Cabinet Office, as well as the Treasury, and we've been looking at why the centre is not working as well as it needs to.
The centre isn't strategic, with governments usually failing to define their priorities. They get into micromanagement and sometimes develop a bunker mentality. And it's unbalanced, with a powerful Treasury often left to fill the strategic vacuum created by an underpowered number 10 and a Cabinet Office with an ever-growing list of responsibilities. This can and must be rectified. So, having identified the problems, the Commission has made 7 key proposals to solve them. The Government should agree its priorities at the start of a Parliament and announce them as part of a modernised King's Speech to set a clear direction for departments and other parts of government to follow. The Prime Minister should appoint an Executive Cabinet Committee made up of just a few key ministers to help them make the most important strategic decisions. The Prime Minister should appoint a senior First Secretary of State with responsibility for delivering the government's priorities and ministerial responsibility for the civil service, freeing up the Prime Minister to retain a more strategic, long-term view. The Cabinet Office and Number 10 should be restructured into a department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet and a separate department for the civil service to strengthen support for the Prime Minister and more effectively coordinate and reform the civil service. There should be a new statute for the civil service and civil service board to hold its leadership accountable for delivery. The roles of Cabinet Secretary, accountable to the Prime Minister, and Head of the Civil Service, accountable to the First Secretary, should be filled separately to give the civil service the leadership it deserves. The priorities for government should be fully reflected in a new shared strategy, budget and performance management process owned collectively at the centre of government to better coordinate, budget for and deliver long-term and cross-cutting priorities.
We cannot have the centre continuing to fail to give the nation the leadership and the Prime Minister the support that they need.
By this time next year, we will have had a general election. Whoever wins and forms the next government should implement our reforms without delay.
Okay, so that's a little snapshot for you of what we're saying. And now I'm really delighted to welcome Sir John Major to reflect on our conclusions and to reflect on the centre. Thank you so much, Sir John.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Hannah. Thank you, Anthony, and good morning, everyone. I am in no doubt at all that the Commission's right to address the serious problems at the centre of government. And it's very evident, once you've read the report, that a very great deal of care has gone into the consideration of their reforms. So let me say at the outset that I think we owe the Commission a very great debt for their work. Now, I'm told, but I haven't myself seen, that some media outlets have attributed views to me this morning that, how best to put this, are misleading. So my own remarks this morning will clarify that view and put it in context. But two other contextual points first. It's now over a quarter of a century since I left government, so I may be out of date. And I belong to that strand of conservatism that prefers evolutionary change to radical disruption, and so I may be out of fashion as well. And yet, I believe there is more than one way to reach a common objective. And I suspect as this debate begins, there will be more agreements on the objectives of the reforms than there will be about some of the details of the reforms. And it is, of course, the objectives that will matter in the end. As Kipling put it succinctly, there are 69 ways of constructing tribal lays, and every single one of them is right. Now, I will illustrate the 69 ways to an extent shortly. Immediately, let me say this. I strongly agree with the Commission's first principle of maximum delegation from the centre, to departments, to public bodies, to local governments. In a democracy, power is safest when it is spread around. And if we fail to delegate, we waste rich resources of manpower and experience in every part of our political and administrative system. But with delegation, one side effect people may not think about, with delegation, senior ministers will have more time to think and to plan, which many of you may think is a good idea. But as the Commission states, where responsibilities are delegated, the money must be provided to deliver them, which hasn't always been the case. Some departments of state clearly are under-resourced to meet their statutory obligations. As for local government, in my view, it now needs a comprehensive reform of its financing. The report proposes, as you've just heard, that at the beginning of every parliament, the Prime Minister should set out the priorities and guiding principles of his or her government. Undoubtedly, the public has a right to know this. I would simply observe that in an ideal world, the party leaders should set out those principles before the nation votes rather than after the nation votes. Manifestos these days are rightly treated with a certain degree of scepticism. Stated principles, I think, should fare a good deal better. The report proposes also an inner cabinet of senior ministers. I see why they do that. I agree that the cabinet at present is too large and cumbersome, especially when attendance is swollen by a significant number of non-cabinet members as well. Now, that should stop unless the attendees are crucial to a particular discussion. Ideally, the full cabinet should be better focused and, I think, significantly trimmed in size itself. It should not, as described to me by one cabinet minister, become merely an extended briefing session for those attending. But, there are practical drawbacks to a formal inner cabinet. It would alienate those who are excluded. It would change the collegiate nature of the wider cabinet and diminish the perception for it. And it would make reshuffles an absolute nightmare for prime ministers. And I promise you, they are difficult enough without that added problem. Now, that said, the Commission's objective, and here's where I come to the objective point again, the Commission's objective of a smaller decision-making body to advise Cabinet could be achieved by appointing an informal Cabinet subcommittee of appropriate ministers or ad hoc meetings chaired by the Prime Minister. Both of those strategies have been used in the past. Both of them, I would commend for the future. I agree very strongly, too, with the proposal to appoint a first Secretary of State. And let me explain why. A first Secretary who might have operational ownership of policy delivery could be a much-needed progress chaser on policy and a conciliator of departmental disputes, not least over public spending, where they will arise inevitably year upon year. But again, this would be a difficult post to fill. Any first secretary would need real authority, would need to be a senior and experienced politician, a Willie Whitelaw or a Michael Heseltine, let us say. And such individuals are not always easy to find. The report recommends a new department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet and a separate civil service department. There's bound to be more than one view upon this. It's a subject that will arouse a certain degree of controversy, I think. The intention, again, is similar. The intention is greater efficiency at the centre, and that is an intention that must be taken seriously. But I am intensely wary of how the implications might work out. New departments with large bureaucracies, allied to the reality of human ambition, which you sometimes see in politics, even in the administrative side of it, suggest an aggregation, a growth of power at the centre, rather than a delegation of power from the centre, which is the first principle that the Commission set out. We are not a presidency. Personally, I do not wish to see an increase in the power of Number 10. Constitutionally, the Prime Minister has few powers. In practice, he or she has many, simply because of the position they hold. With a large majority, a Prime Minister can be almost unconstrained in his or her actions. We see that in many pseudo-democracies. My preference is quite clear. I prefer effective cabinet effective cabinet government to prime ministerial diktat. I may be wrong. It may be that I'm out of date and those particular changes are desirable, but I admit, frankly, I am uneasy about them. Now, number 10 is a very different place than once it was. I go back into the dark ages, perhaps. But in the 1980s and 90s, number 10 had about 100 staff. It now has 3.5 times that number, at, no doubt, 3.5 times the cost. Yet I have seen no evidence yet, not shown to me, certainly, that it is 3.5 times more efficient. Indeed, hearsay suggests precisely the opposite. Similarly, in the 2000s, the Cabinet Office had around 1,600 staff. I am told it now has over 10,000. That is, of course, partly because of Europe, because the preparation done for the European referendum was inadequate. After the referendum had been had voted the way it did, many new decisions had to be taken that had not been considered, and they were all just loaded on to the Cabinet Office, which accounts for that huge swelling in numbers. Yet even so, I'm unconvinced it's more efficient. I'm equally dubious about splitting the roles of Cabinet Secretary and Head of the Civil Service. Again, a controversial point, and one that's arisen before. I will explain why. The civil service is the delivery arm of government, the engine of the whole machine. Its work is absolutely crucial. If the civil service fails, government fails. For those reasons and others I have no time to include, I believe its head should be the most senior civil servant, the only one with daily and direct access to the Prime Minister, and that is the Cabinet Secretary. We can be proud of the UK's reputation as one of, some would say the, most stable democracy in the world. We should cherish this. But if the government or parliament fails to meet the standards expected by the public, then trust in our political system will fail. I regard it as essential for our future to attract more of our most able people to Parliament and to the civil service. I remember speaking to schools and universities many years ago and asking how many wanted to go into elected or non-elected public service. And practically 40 to 50% said yes. Today, it is very nearly a nil return. And that is not healthy for the administration or the politics of government. Let me add a brief personal note here. Let me be clear about this. Three prime ministers in one parliament, with a few malcontents seeking a fourth, does not help the perception of the centre of government. Nor does a Supreme Court ruling that the government has broken the law. Nor is it a good optic when ministers indulge in public arguments, openly blame, or in one or two occasions insult their civil servants. Or when they favour the advice of often inexperienced political advisers over that of civil servants with years of specialist experience and knowledge. Or when they sack senior civil servants who offered candid advice which simply did not suit the government's thinking. I know of one who told me he was removed because he was, I quote, not one of us. Nor should he have been. The role of the civil servant is not to be one of us, not to be partisan, but to benefit policy by possessing an institutional memory and offering impartial advice without fear or favour. If he is going to be moved because the advice is unwelcome, then he will not offer advice to the ministers that perhaps they should have, and that will not help the administration of government or the policy of the elected administration. Now, none of that conduct is conducive to high morale or good government. Our politics needs changes to create and project a far more effective and trusted system. So let me just summarise, and I apologise that there were many aspects of the report that I simply haven't been able to cover because it is very, very extensive. So let me summarise. Our democracy cannot be static. It needs refreshing and it needs updating to protect it from harm, and to restore its reputation. So I would like to thank the Commission for their timely, their powerful, and their valuable contribution to this debate. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much, Sir John. And now please give a warm welcome to Gordon Brown.
Thank you very much. Can I first of all thank Hannah and the Institute of Government, and David Sainsbury in particular. The Institute of Government is now a recognised national institution after only 14 years of existence. And can I thank Anthony and his colleagues for the report that you've done, which I've read with a great deal of interest. And can I also, I think, extend my thanks to John Major. It's a sign of the times that we find ourselves more on the same side than on opposite sides. And I think I've got to reassure you, and I think John would do the same, that we're not trying to make Cameron-style comebacks here. I've said before I'm too old for British politics and too young for American politics. And it is remarkable. A few years ago, John and I and Tony were three former prime ministers, and now there are seven. And the Conservative Party seems to have found the magic formula for a mass production of ex-prime ministers, with perhaps some more to come. We shall see. W.B. Yeats has this famous phrase that the centre cannot hold. And I suppose the theme of this report is that the centre cannot manage well enough. And I remember when I was an academic and we used to talk about the 1950s and the 1960s and the 1970s. We said in the 1950s we managed decline, in the 1960s we mismanaged decline, in the 1970s we declined to manage. And we're in a sense reporting on a position now where people feel that the centre needs to be repurposed, it needs to be reconfigured, and it needs to find better ways of managing its own affairs. And so I can say that I do support most of the findings in the report. I do think they will stand the test of time. I do think they will provide the basis for any future government both to legislate and to devise the way that it is going to govern in the future. I think the idea of a second Secretary of State in charge of the civil service and in charge of managing delivery is a very good idea. I think the streamlining of the budget process and the audit process is something that is long overdue. I think the other suggestions about the Cabinet Secretary and the head of the civil service I will come to in a second. But generally speaking, I think we're dealing with something that is long overdue in terms of reform. I was quite shocked, and John mentioned some of the figures, to find that while when I left government, we were being accused of a bloated bureaucracy, we were being accused of a centre that was overpowerful, of big government and everything else, that the civil service numbers are now far higher than they were in 2010, that the cabinet office has risen from 6,000 to more than 10,000, that number 10, as John said, has gone up from, I think, what it was, about 200 to about 350, that the cabinet secretariat, domestic and economic secretariat, was about 40 and it's now 120, that the Treasury itself was 1,600 and is now over 2,000, and some say with all the departments linked to it, it's nearly 3,000. And so we've had a massive rise in the numbers of bureaucrats in certain positions in the centre without, as John's saying, the results to prove it. So we are going to need rationalisation, we're going to need modernisation, but most of all, we're going to need the coordination of strategic government for the future. And so I come to these proposals that John has mentioned. And here, John, I think unusually we have to disagree on two issues. While it's a very crude distinction between policy initiation and policy implementation, I think it is too much to expect that the person who is the Secretary of the Cabinet is also going to be head of the civil service effectively. I remember Jeremy Hayward saying that this was his fifth priority to head the civil service because there were four priorities before that. So I can see the logic of a civil service act which has as its basis a requirement on the head of the civil service to be responsible for the management of the civil service and to be accountable, yearly reporting to Parliament for that accountability. And I believe that that distinction between the Cabinet Secretary responsible, if away, for the political process of developing and then getting agreement on policy, and the administration of it with nearly 500,000 civil servants is something that can be dealt with in a far better way than we're doing at the moment. I would support a Civil Service Act as well, because that would give the head of the civil service both the authority and the responsibility. It would make it clear where the responsibilities were to lie, and it would make it clear what the accountability it was. So I can genuinely say that my experience was perhaps a bit different from John, that when we were facing a financial crisis, and I'll come to say something about that in a second, we needed both these jobs to be done by people who could give their full-time commitment to doing that. Now, I say none of this without great respect for the civil service. I remember when I was leaving government for the last time in 2010, saying to Jeremy Hayward, would you pass a note to David Cameron, saying that he was inheriting the best civil service in the world? And I added to David, I think something like, the country's in good hands, Jeremy's running it. So I have no disrespect for the civil service when I make these proposals, but change there has to be, and change is necessary. And this is the main reason why I think change has got to happen quickly. We are in a make or break decade for our economy. Our growth levels are half what they were in the last two or three decades. Our productivity levels are now lower. The growth rate is now lower than it was at any time, academics tell me, since the Industrial Revolution. Investment in this country is far lower as a percentage of national income than almost all our major competitors. The regional economic inequalities in our country are now so serious that they demand urgent action. And of course, as a result of that, standards of living for people in this country are continuing to fall. There has got to be a turnaround strategy. We cannot govern in the way we have been doing if we are going to make this a decade when we can see an economic recovery in our fortunes. We need to think with almost military precision about how we can put our economy on a war footing so that we are in a position to solve the problems that I've just identified. Now, the report suggests that the Treasury distorts priorities and distorts relationships and fills a vacuum that is left, of course, when a Prime Minister or the Cabinet Office is unable to act. And there have been massive numbers of innovations over these last 50 or 60 years to try to rectify this problem, to create a better way of managing economic policy. We had the Department of Economic Affairs. We then had the Industrial Strategy of a National Enterprise Board. We then had this episode where Sir Alan Walters appeared to be running economic policy from some far-off country under Mrs. Thatcher, and alienating Nigel Lawson, prompting him in the end to resignation. We had the joint economic unit that I think Dominic Cummings set up to try to neutralise some of the power of the Treasury. We had Liz Truss, I remember, suggesting that number 10 would become the economic nerve centre. I think it became the loss of nerve centre after a few weeks. And we've had all these innovations as an attempt to try to circumvent the power of the Treasury, or alternatively to neuter some of its power, or certainly to do things differently from previous management in economic policy. And this, I feel, is at the heart of the problem that we're going to have to deal with when we face all the economic problems over these next few years. And I cannot see a way that will justify circumventing or neutralising the Treasury. What I do see is that the Treasury should be at the centre of economic policy making alongside number 10, the Prime Minister and the Cabinet Office, and we have got to find a better mechanism for setting economic policy, and indeed public expenditure policy, in the future than we've had in the past. Now, in 2009, in my frustration about our ability to move forward out of the recession, we created a National Economic Council. And that was not NEDI, it was not a National Economic Development Council. It was a council of all the ministers and in some of the agencies that were concerned with the management of economic policy. And that included transport, of course, and infrastructure, housing, employment, included obviously industry and business, and all the territorial departments as well. And I believe that is the model that we should be thinking of as we look at the huge and complex economic challenges that we face in the future. Now, it depends on the Treasury not returning to being simply a finance department, but it has to be an economic department. Some of you who know the history of the Treasury know that in the 1920s and 1930s, when Keynes was pushing his ideas for economic growth, the permanent secretary of the Treasury at the time got hold of Keynes's pamphlet, How to Conquer Unemployment, which was the recipe to return to growth, and marked upon it three words only that are still in the Treasury library: inflation, extravagance, bankruptcy. And that's how Keynes was written off. If the Treasury retreats into a comfort zone, which is simply being a finance department, and simply managing debt and deficit reduction, and it's easier to do that because that is these are figures that are manageable. And if it retreats from being an economic department, because it can always argue, of course, that growth is not being achieved because of international factors, supply side difficulties, trade restrictions, even the weather. But if it really restricts itself to being a finance department, then to me, there is not much hope for the Treasury to be able to contribute to the economic agenda in the way it should. But if the Treasury, working as an economic department, with Number 10, at a National Economic Council, chaired by the Prime Minister and the Chancellor, jointly staffed by the Treasury and the Cabinet Office, then in my view, we have a chance to break out of some of the difficulties that we've had in the past. It deals with the problem that the Treasury has too much power. It deals with the problem that the Prime Minister has too limited power in these issues. It forces an interdepartmental collegiality about dealing with the problems that we face. And in my view, is something that perhaps the authors of the report might consider as a follow-up to look at how economic policy in these very difficult times ahead could be better managed in the future. Of course, there is another criticism of the Treasury in the report, and that is that it is secretive and it is not open with people. I don't think that can be upheld so much now when you have a budget that was that was leaked in a way that Hugh Dalton had to resign as Chancellor in 1948 because of telling people about the budget beforehand. But historically, of course, the Treasury has been very worried about secrecy and maintaining a sense that it can get on with its business. And this was in the term budget purdo. I'm told it arose because of an incident in, I think, 1906, when the Treasury decided to have an open debate in the country about the purchase of dreadnoughts for the Admiralty. The Admiralty wanted six, the Treasury wanted four. They had a huge public debate and a slogan about, we want eight and we won't wait, and the Treasury lost out entirely. And instead of four or six, they had to give in to there being eight. So the Treasury has got to be more open, the Treasury has got to be less secretive, the Treasury has got to be more accountable in that direction. But in my view, a National Economic Council is the way forward, including all the government ministers and the agencies responsible for economic policy. And I would suggest three other things side by side with that. The productivity and enterprise unit of the Treasury has got to be central to the working out of an industrial sector strategy, which we desperately need if we're going to mobilise the country's advantages in IT and AI, in medical technologies, and indeed in environmental technologies. We have got to be in a position where we can bring in my view, outside expertise, and I think the civil service has at times been very reluctant to do so. I remember when I wanted to bring in people during the financial crisis from the financial world to help us, it became very difficult. And obviously, there are conflicts of interest involved. And the easiest thing to do was appoint someone as a minister in the House of Lords rather than appoint them as a civil servant on a temporary basis. And of course, you get the usual reaction, minister, it's under consideration. Then you ask a week later, it's under active consideration. Then a week later, it's under active and intensive consideration. And then a week later, well, there are technical and legal difficulties, and then a week later say, well, there are also issues of principle, shouldn't we have a wider consultation? And then a few weeks later, it's getting very near the general election. I don't think we can make major changes at this stage. So there are ways that you can circumvent some of the changes, but I do believe we are going to need to find better ways of dealing with these conflicts of interest that prevent us bringing in people from the outside, as happens in other successful economies, when there are issues to deal with. And my final point is this, in the reform of government, we need to recognise, and John said this at the beginning when he talked about delegation, and I'm going to talk about devolution, that we are not a unitary state, that we are a multinational state, and there are many regions to be taken into account in this arena, and that we have got to consistently devolve power to those areas where economic decisions can be better made, and where there are clusters of innovative technologies, we should be in a position at a local level with R&D support, with skills support, with training support, in infrastructure support to do something to help them move forward. So I believe that accompanying a National Economic Council, there's got to be a council of the nations and regions that brings together the devolved authorities, the mayors and others, to discuss the development of economic and indeed of social policy as well. And I believe that any reform of the centre would be incomplete unless we took into account the need both to devolve power, but also the need to build the coordination mechanisms that are absolutely essential if the country is to hold together and at the same time to make progress in all those areas of economic and social policy where you need collaboration, when you need cooperation between the different units of government to make things work. So I would have a council of nations and regions. I would have a regional growth unit, probably based in the Treasury. I would be determined that in this reform of government, we don't concentrate only on the centre, but we concentrate on the balance between the centre and the rest of the country. And I do say again, if we do not do that, we will face increasing pressures in the different parts of the country, and not just in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, but in the regions of England, where they will not be happy with a centralising government that does not take into account, as John and I are now both saying, the need to delegate and to devolve to the constituent parts, but also to build the mechanisms by which you can coordinate successfully rather than simply devolve and forget, which unfortunately has been the policy for too long. So the aim is very clear. Instead of developing some of the potential of some of the regions of some of the, in some parts of the country, we can develop, which is absolutely central to our economic growth in the future, where productivity is so low in many parts of the country, we can develop all of the potential of all of the regions and nations in all of our country. Thank you, Anthony and Hannah, for such an important report. I'm sure it's going to guide a future Labour government. I've seen this morning in the Times that your proposal, which I didn't mention at the beginning, for an inner cabinet has already gained some support in a briefing to the Times. The suggestion is an inner cabinet of four, which I think John and I would both be quite shocked at and surprised if that could ever work. Triumvirates have been pretty difficult in the first place, but to have a quadrumvirate is very difficult. The historical experience of that is pretty inauspicious, if I may say so. King Herod was part of a quadrumvirate where the four of them governed the Roman Empire, and you can take it right through to recent times and the Gang of Four, which, if I remember right, has not survived to tell much of the tale now. So I think the inner cabinet idea may need some further work. And I doubt, as John said, if the other 20 members of the cabinet would be very happy if they were told that they were outside this inner circle. But there's no doubt, of course, there are formal and informal mechanisms by which you can deal with the problem. And none of this is to take away from the very great importance of this report. Of what I do emphasise is the need for a Civil Service Act. I think that is something that is vital for the future. But I do think we should concentrate on what is going to be the major issue of the next few years, and that is building an economic policy that works. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Gordon. We're going to move now to the panel section of this event. Before we do so, I do just want to make clear that it absolutely, as Sir John said, there's been some misleading reporting of the involvement of Sir John and Gordon in this event today. This is very much the IFG's report. Anthony Seldon and myself as chair, they, as you have heard, don't agree with everything in the report, but with some of it, so that's good. I'm delighted to welcome Louise and Gus to the stage. So before we begin the panel discussion, I just wanted to say a few more words about why we think this is such an important piece of work. You will have noticed, the two former prime ministers have just reminded us that there have been one or two reports in the past about how to improve government and the civil service. The reality is the same problems get identified again and again. Weak levers in number 10, rubber levers, prime ministers say when they get in there. Muddied responsibilities, which mean no one is held to account for better government. An excessive churn of civil servants and of ministers, which we've seen on steroids, really, in recent years, which means that there's a problem with institutional memory and that progress is difficult to make. And that means that real transformative change happens very rarely. Now, one of the principles, as Sir John noted, that's guided our thinking is that the centre should only do what can only be done at the centre. And one of the things that can only be done at the centre, we think, is to lead reform of government. But that will only happen if somebody is charged with making it happen. And although some of our other recommendations, which you've heard about already, may be higher profile and more controversial, our argument for having clear civil service leadership, which is held accountable for delivering that change, we think, underpinned by a statute, as Gordon was just saying, is really at the heart of what we're arguing here. We think having an effective centre is a prerequisite for the rest of government being effective, and in turn for tackling society's biggest problems. So today we've set out our arguments, and we are also aiming to set off a debate. I think we've already started to do that, and we're hoping it will spur whoever forms the next government into action from the moment they enter number 10. So, moving on to our panel discussion, I'm very pleased to welcome, alongside Sir Anthony Seldon, Baroness Casey, who of course is a crossbench peer, former Director General in the Department of Communities and Local Government, and has had a long and varied career in government. I have a list.
No need to read it out. We're short on time.
I think most people know exactly who you are. But of course, most recently, Louise has led the Independent Review of the Metropolitan Police and stepped up during the pandemic to lead the COVID-19 Rough Sleeping Task Force, part of her long-standing commitment to that issue. And Lord O'Donnell, of course, needs very little introduction as well, served as Cabinet Secretary and Head of the Civil Service, both under Prime Ministers Tony Blair, Gordon Brown and John Major. And prior to that was Permanent Secretary of the Treasury and Press Secretary to John Major.
I was Press Secretary to John Major, not his Cabinet Secretary.
Sorry, Treasury, yes. And now chairs Frontier Economics.
Yes.
Welcome to you both. So I'm just going to kick off with a couple of questions and then we'll open to the floor for questions. Anthony, as my deputy chair, ask you to kick off. Why did you come to the IFG with the idea for this commission?
Because I think there are moments in history, and both Sir John and Gordon have alluded to that, where there is simply the case for change. 1945 was one such moment, 1964, 1979, 1997, and this is one such moment where, Hannah, as you said, it is apparent to most people that it's not right, that there we have to do the centre better. We might disagree, and I think that's good and healthy that we're disagreeing about how to improve it, but it's clear that if we don't grab this moment, not the least, as Gordon was saying, the economic woes, the backlog of broken infrastructure, of public services which are overstretched, the impact of AI, we have Martha Lane Fox at the back, one of our commissioners, simply are not being considered. There's so much work that's not been done by the current system. So that's why the moment seemed auspicious, Hannah, and the IFG, obviously. This is a superb body, and that David Sainsbury has set up, and the right body to do it academically, objectively, fairly, involving not just the people who have seen government work best at the in the past, stream number one, two, what works best at the centre abroad. Australia was a particular influence. And third, what can we learn from the private sector, which are running similarly highly complex bodies? And there is much that we can learn. And those are the streams and the receptivity. And can I just say, Hannah, that working with the IFG has been a joy. And working with Alex Thomas, who was private secretary to Jeremy Hayward, much mentioned, much missed, along with Emma Norris and Jordan Urban. And the whole team. It's been a very happy, experience.
And would you like to reflect on some of the comments we've heard from Sir John and from Gordon Brown?
So I think that they're broadly in agreement that much needs to happen. And there's that special club, isn't there, of former prime ministers. It used to be quite an exclusive club, that no one else quite sees it the same way. Nobody else quite sees it the same way as the former cabinet secretaries either, and there are a number, including Robin Butler, in the audience here. And Hannah, I do think that we have come out with the right suggestions. I think that no private company would have a finance department and a chief financial officer going off with his own thing and the chief executive with their own plan, because that dissonance is unhelpful. And it's particularly unhelpful now. So we do agree with Gordon Brown that we have to have a strong Treasury, but a Treasury working in lockstep with the Prime Minister, who, let us remember, is the first Lord of the Treasury. The Chancellor is only the second Lord. I do think, similarly, that we do have to split those offices. Let's remember that when the Cabinet Secretary was set up in 1916, there had already been a long-standing office of head of the civil service, which has a very different skill set. They were reunited 40 years later when the great Edward Bridges stood down, not entirely successfully, and there have been periods when it's worked well, but the Cabinet Secretary is one job, and the head of the civil service, which goodness needs, as we've been hearing, it needs refortifying. I have children in the civil service. We've never had a Conservative government that has chosen so to attack the institutions of the British state. It needs both refortifying, but it also needs rebuilding and modernising, and I think it needs a specialist. So, you know, we can talk more, but there's honest disagreement. Out of those disagreements, sometimes, alongside the much that we agree on, will come a greater clarity for whoever wins the general election in presumably the autumn.
Thanks very much, Anthony. Louise, can I turn to you?
Yes.
There's a bit of a established Casey method to dealing with a problem: identify a problem, scramble a team, and fix it, essentially. So we feel like you're quite well placed to comment on whether you think our proposals will help governments identify the right problems and sort out how to fix them.
Well, it's a tad more complicated than scrambling a team. I mean, I suppose that a couple of broader comments, really, I think, Hannah. And first of all, alongside everybody else, I think it's the right time to be having this conversation and to be thinking differently and testing and thinking things through. And I'm enormously grateful to the Institute for Government and indeed the sponsors for doing this. You've got a long history of doing it, so it's very welcome. I mean, I suppose what I think is actually that we need to get the country, in my mind, back on its feet, that there are the dissonance between the centre and the lived experience of people's lives is too great from potholes through to food banks, through to actually people carrying a job and it doesn't pay enough money for them to have a holiday or to deal with ULEZ or whatever. I just think it sort of, it's not just one. I used to worry about minority issues like rough sleeping that actually started the solution under Sir John Major and continued under the Labour. So I used to be more concerned in my earlier periods, as it were, about what would be a minority, like who is destitute, who is affected by when the system doesn't work. And now I'm concerned and have been in more in the sort of 10, 15 years, really, at a much wider landscape. So I think in this, I would say the centre has to do better because it has to support secretaries of state and departments to do what they're supposed to be doing well rather than replace it. And I think there's a real danger for people that are concerned about the centre is they forget what the centre is there to do, which is to implement the ministerial choices of the day and to get them done as locally as possible. So I think there's a real danger that you think about, you know, restructuring Whitehall, as in 70, and or Downing Street, and you forget about what does a new Secretary of State need, or someone that's been a Secretary of State before but doesn't feel they can get anything done. What will the centre do to support that? So that would be my first reflection. I also think effectiveness of ministers and civil servants is something that might as well be out there, that, you know, effective prime ministers govern, don't just accept power. Effective ministers govern. So I think, again, it's like, how do we have that conversation in a rather febrile and challenging environment? I think the trade-off between ministers blaming civil servants and civil servants blaming ministers just has to stop. It just need to call a shot on it, whoever wins the next election. But I am slightly worried about the centre not just being there potentially for the man or indeed one day, again, the woman at the top, but actually there in order to make sure that the Secretary of State and ministers, because nowadays I feel there's been job creep, as it were. So what used to be done by an EO has to be done by an HEO, which has to be done by an SEO. Then you've got, sorry, I'm in civil service ease here for a minute. And then, you know, you've just seen this enormous job creep upwards. And I think we've seen the same with the number of people that think they have to be around the cabinet table as a minister attending cabinet. I can't remember when the minister attending cabinet started, but it seems to have grown in numbers. And actually, it's not sort of, you know, it's got to be pushed out. And the same way, like we're thinking about the population of Yorkshire is bigger than the population of Scotland. And, you know, the population of Wales is 3 million. The population of Yorkshire is 5 million. You know, the voices of areas of the country, not just economically in the way Gordon talked about, but more broadly. And I look at all these mayoral models and realise some have got some power, some have other power, some cover this, some cover that. You know, I'm worried about that as much as I'm worried about where the furniture is going to be in 70 and in Downing Street. So my other plea would be sort of forward thinking, not done in every department. So that's, you know, everybody does horizon scanning nowadays. And it's bloody annoying if you're in a department and every grade 7 is trooping across to talk to you about horizon scanning. There is a role for the centre in doing that for you. And I've written here checkup mechanisms. If you want to get something done, having too many people doing checkup mechanisms is really frustrating for those of us that are trying to get something done, whether that's as a Secretary of State, a minister, a senior civil servant or otherwise. And then my last thing, because I think I'll just get out of the way, because I know you're going to ask me about it, is this great thing about bringing people in from outside. And I still find it entertaining, and actually the very wonderful Moira Wallace is in the room today as well. And she fought for my arrival into Whitehall, I believe. No, she's shaking her head. She's disowned me now. She's totally disowned me many years later. But I think what's interesting about people coming in from the outside, as it said, and I completely agree with what Gordon said, is there's a very clear role for that. I think we're crap at it. I think I think they have enormous expectations. They're going to be sat next to the Prime Minister every day, and they'll be in the inner sanctum of Downing Street because their issue is the most important issue, and they don't understand why that doesn't happen. They find themselves in a basement with no carpet at the back of Whitehall. True story. I was sent off to see a perfectly good bloke that they put, not David Cameron, I don't think, put in the House of Lords because he couldn't find enough the mechanism. He wanted to do something on social capital. I get a call from Jeremy Hayward's office saying, could you go and give said Lord a bit of advice on how to handle Whitehall? I went to the back, I went even further into the back of 70. I looked down the staircase, realised the carpet stopped and there was no carpet down. And in the back was this bloke that thought he was about to run the world. And I thought, well, the message is clear to you, mate, where your office is and the amount of support the civil service is going to give you, because they didn't give him any. So I always think they're sort of swimming in your lane. And I think some people that and I have not swum in my lane, and the person to my left has had to help me be back in that lane at various points in my 20 years in Whitehall. So I think effectiveness of ministers and civil servants has to be part of what reform is. If restructure does not always make something effective. And so you can fiddle with things and you can restructure things, but if people aren't clear on what their responsibilities are to govern and to be civil servants helping those people govern, my caveat for do the centre better is that it has to be done better so it supports action outside Whitehall, within departments and then further outside. And I don't see that. I'm slightly worried about mission government. I'm slightly worried about the current government. I don't see what's going to change for the public as we go forward into 2025. And then I would just put a caution down about huge delivery units that actually think they know better than actually... It's a bit like telling a dustman, or sorry, refuse collector, that you know how to take the refuse out better than the refuse collector. Well, jog on, because normally you haven't done it in your life. You're not going to do it anytime soon. You just want me to fill out a Gantt chart. And let's not bring back the era of Gantt charts, because I can't bear it. That's all I have to say.
Thank you very much, Louise. And I think one of the things that absolutely came through powerfully throughout the commission was precisely your point about the importance of the quality of people at the centre. We felt as a commission we couldn't actually go out and find those people. And from the other point of view, you're absolutely right. Structures can't solve things. But I think we have seen also, particularly with the COVID inquiry and so on, that having the wrong structures can mess stuff up and make it hard for good people to be as effective as they might be.
The thing about the Quad, which Gordon mentioned, which I was brought back because they made a public commitment that they needed somebody to help sort out. I thought what was interesting about it is that it was there was much stronger communication and openness. Yeah. I mean, obviously, people paid quite a high cost for that, but. And I've always felt that the Treasury is a sort of... I really like Gordon's vision for it being the sort of powerhouse of economic change, as opposed to the people that basically tell you, we need to reduce money, you need to stop spending, and again, sometimes have views on policy. So instead of saying, Louise, I'm sorry, you're not going to turn around the lives of 100 and whatever thousand families, because I will say this is what I think we need... They will say, we can only have half of it, at which point you compromise on the policy. And I think danger lies in that direction. And I think that's when you see governments sort of have to manage away and have handling strategies and lines to take because they're not delivering. And so I would rather have, less or fewer, I can never remember which one it is, but a smaller number of things that people say they're going to deliver on, that the Treasury are there to support the delivery of it, through God willing economic growth, so that things outside Whitehall, whether they're in Surrey or Sunderland, get better. Sorry, that was
mine. I think we would absolutely agree with that. Gus, in this report, we talk, and we've talked today, about a strategic vacuum at the heart of government and the need to identify outcomes, just as Louise is saying, and set strategy, and then to reflect that more collectively through spending reviews. What are your reflections on those recommendations?
So, first of all, just to thank the Institute and Anthony and you for a report which has stimulated massive debate. And to thank my two former bosses there, because they always respected, and have ever since they left office, respected the civil service and been voices of reason in this debate. So thank you for that. It's been enormously important, I think, as we've seen that behaviour not reflected in some of your successes. The report, I think, the report, to my mind, I'm 80% of you with diagnosis. Completely, there are so many things wrong. The Cabinet Office and Number 10 are way too big. Far too many special advisers, far too many civil servants. Shrink it down, both of them. I strongly agree with the point, which I think people really underestimate, is the importance, it's your first thing, importance of outcomes. If only governments would be absolutely clear what outcomes they want. You know, I remember, God forbid, the coalition talks, right? 5 days, we come out with a list of tasks, right? That is not the way to govern, okay? So getting outcomes right and then working out what are the processes for which we're going to deliver. So I would stress to both parties ahead of an election, please think about what outcomes you want to achieve, and then we'll help you determine what are the best ways of doing them. I do think, as you rightly say, there is a complete vacuum in terms of strategy. I remember actually a recent conversation I had with John Burt about a strategy unit in Number 10, which I actually don't think did strategy particularly. They did blue skies thinking, they did lots of things. But I do think there's a case for there being a strategy which Number 10 oversees, which brings together all the departments, right? You have to then say, so what's the vehicle for implementing a strategy? And I'm sorry, but I've kind of rewritten a report that I want to do that how I solve all the problems that I've thrown out. And I think the way you implement a strategy is you've got to have money in there, so you've got to have the Treasury involved. You need a spending review. I would have a 10-year spending review. I'd have the spending review overseen by the OBR as well, so that they can, at the moment, they only do the revenue side, and the spending side's a joke. We all know that, because the future plans are ridiculous, right? So bringing the two together, getting the OBR to look at them, I think will be really good. I would definitely have an informal team under Cabinet. That I certainly wouldn't institutionalise it, because it depends on people and politics. You take the Quad. I came up with wonderful ideas at the coalition, how they could work together, all completely rubbish, right? And when they got together, they found, because the people and the politics worked for them to have a Quad, who would have thought 50-50, Conservative, Lib Dem? I mean, and it worked. So I'm very much of that, but please don't institutionalise it. Make it work with a much slimmed down Cabinet. Please, no one attending Cabinet. And not just round that main table, but round the outside as well. A smaller number of higher quality SPADs, I think, would be massively useful. Let's talk about the two other points of controversy that came up. One is the Treasury. Right? As a former permanent secretary of the Treasury, you know, I've spent decades there. You're going to. I do think a strong Treasury is really important. But let me be clear. What a lot of people, and sometimes the report kind of goes there, is thinking of this as a boxing match, and the Treasury is the heavyweight, and alas, the departments or Number 10 are the flyweight. And so we need to build up the flyweight. To my mind, whenever you have a boxing match with two heavyweights, you get blood on the floor and not much else, right? Change the language of this debate, change the structure. Gordon mentioned it. Gordon had National Economic Council, I remember, during our day. I think the National Security Council that the coalition set up was a brilliant initiative. I think it works incredibly well. What it does is brings together ministers and senior officials. And that's what you need, right? We've got too often, we've got ministers meeting here with briefings given to them by civil servants, and the civil servants meet separately and go, oh my God, what are they going to do? And they're saying the same. And it just doesn't work. Yeah. So much more of that. You wouldn't be able to call it the National Economic Council, because my history tells me that you can never use the same words. You have to change the name. So we'll call it a National Growth Council or something. But so that's where I would get with the Treasury. I think a strong Treasury is really important, because you look at that Cabinet table and there are so many people whose political capital goes up if they spend more money, and very few who have to raise it. There was, oh yes, the Cabinet Secretary. Let's get to that. So there are some, I have a say in this. I think how I can explain this debate, basically, I've lived through periods where when I left the job, they split it between Cabinet Secretary and Head of Civil Service. It didn't work, right? Everyone accepts it didn't work. And that's happened in the past. And I think the point is, if you just split the jobs, what you end up with is a head of the civil service with no power, no influence with the prime minister. They just don't get anywhere. So now, as I understand the way that certainly David is thinking about this, is we change things so that we actually have some kind of civil service act or some kind of shift which allows the head of civil service to have real power and responsibility. Now, that's an interesting idea. I'm really interested in exploring how that might work. But if you just split the jobs, it won't work. If you just do a repeat of the civil service department, it won't work because we've done it before, it didn't work. They become glorified HR, nobody pays any attention to them. They don't have any power, right? That's the key. You've got to give these people power. We talked about the problem of getting people in from outside. We talked about churn in the civil service. Fundamentally, we've got problems with pay. We give civil servants a huge amount of money when they leave, when they retire. How bonkers is that, right? Let's pay some more, reduce the pension maybe. I have to tell you as an accounting officer that the real gains from actually reducing pension liabilities won't show up anywhere. How stupid is that? So if they really had some power to do that and they could bring people in, as Louise says, it's hard bringing people in, right? I've tried, when you bring in people from industry, for example, business leaders, they want to operate in a certain sort of way, right? And they find it difficult operating in the way that you need to operate in our democracy. They don't understand when you say to them, yes, that Secretary of State wanted this, but actually they're moving. So we've got a new one and they want to do something different. Find that very hard. So I think that churn, I remember when David Cameron asked me during the run-up to the 2010 election, what's the one thing that he could give to me? I said, reduce ministerial churn. Keep people in place as long as possible. And I strongly think the civil service should do the same. So I think there is a lot to be said for a lot of what you've said, but we do need to work through all of these things, get a better strategic centre, make it that... I think a lot of this, people think about working around departments, whereas, in fact, we seem to work with them. And the whole point about devolution, I completely get. The one kind of curious question to you all is, what the principle that you're describing was, I always thought of, it's the word subsidiarity. Mm. Is that not allowed anymore? Is that too EU-friendly so that we can't say it? I'm just wondering. But I do think that that point about the centre doing what the centre is required to do, and there are a number of things strategically, if you want to get planning through and stuff like that, but also devolving as far as you can, as low as you can, I think is... And that requires a reform of local government finance, which I have sat through many times, and it's just like I've sat through many growth plans. We know what to do, and we don't do it. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Gus. So many things I want to come back on, but we're already running over time, and I want to give time to some questions from the floor. So my colleague has a microphone here. So can we go there? Evan, we'll take groups of three, I think.
Evan Davis from the PM programme on Radio 4. Hannah, I think this one might be for you. Can you just tell us what conversations you have been having with actual politicians who might be in government over the next 12 months to 10 years about these proposals and what reception you have had and how much you have been talking to essentially the two main political parties?
Thank you, Evan. Gentleman here.
John Glenn, Paymaster General. I'd just like to observe that I agree very much with what Sir John Major said about the need to have strong permanent secretaries that we rely on and respect. And in my experience in the last 7 years as a minister, I totally agree with that. But I would also agree with what Gordon Brown said about his challenge when he wanted to do something in difficult circumstances. The challenge is to actually bring in the right people at the right time. And I suppose my question is that in order to operationalise the recommendations of this report, yes, you'll have to work through lots of us politicians, but we also have got to come to terms with, over a generation, the changes in the expectations of the general public, realistic or not, about the speed of delivery and the gap between the words of a politician and the reality of delivering government on the ground. And it is easy to commentate about those challenges, rather different in my experience, to deliver. And if we look over the last 10 years, the necessity of changes in structures of government to accommodate some of the decisions we've made at general elections also impose new ways to organise government. So I would just be a little bit cautious about rolling out a one-size-fits-all structural innovation that will deliver that shift that everyone wants. Because I think there has to be a realism about contact with reality, contact with expectations of the public, and also contact with personalities and politicians.
Yeah, thank you. Polly, over there.
Polly McKenzie, a former special advisor. So the recommendations, you've spoken about them a little, Louise, already, from page 71, that look at this question of how we open the civil service to more external expertise, I think are incredibly valuable and a really important part of this report, which I just think is overall excellent in its ambition and focus. I wonder if you can say a bit more about it, because you, Louise, are, I guess, an icon of the bring in a superstar type model. And there aren't that many superstars. And I think the report talks about, again, trying to make the civil service more systematically open, both to people and, of course, ideas, including ideas from citizens themselves. And I wonder if you think that there are structures and ways that we can do that too.
I think in the interest of time, I'll take two more questions and then that will be our questions for today. So if we have two more questions, the lady with the white jacket.
Emma Logan, KPMG. Really interesting report, and perhaps just following on from this gentleman's question here around who you've spoken to. I'd be quite interested to hear, Hannah, and the others on the panel there, which of these seven recommendations do you really feel are likely to get implemented?
Thank you. And Jonathan.
Hi, Jonathan Slater. I used to work for Gus. I think you're saying that number 10 is too in the detail and has too much power over cabinet ministers and departments, and we'd all agree with that. But rather than rebalancing and asserting further the responsibility of Cabinet Office to defend Cabinet government, I think you're sort of giving up and abolishing it and putting it into number 10, is what it looks like. And it may be I've misunderstood it, but I would encourage you not to give up, not to give up at all. On the Today programme this morning, we heard that somebody in number 10 had sacked the chief inspector, and those of us who've worked in the civil service 15 years would probably all know the name of the person who did it. And rather than make that organisation more powerful, rebalance away, I would say. And then finally, since I've mentioned Gus, I'm not sure that you would have proposed splitting his post when he was doing it. Exactly. Because wasn't he really, really good at it? And he had Jeremy Hayward as his number two. And it sort of worked fine then. And doesn't that really prove that, unfortunately, it is in the end about the people? I just don't think you would have done it then. You're doing it now because the people have changed. But the problem hasn't.
Thanks very much. So I think we'll just go down the line, if that's okay, and you know, in the classic politician way, I'll enable you to answer the questions you wish to answer. Mm. I'll just start with an answer to Evan, which is to say, of course, we've been talking to lots of people about the report. And if we think sensibly, lots of people are very interested in the report. We've seen some reporting today that says that Labour are interested in the idea of having a smaller group within the Cabinet to refer to. We think that is something which every prime minister has ended up in some way having an informal version of that. Eventually, we say, why not at the start of your premiership or continuation of your premiership, should it be another Conservative government, do it, set it up properly and give it the support it needs in terms of the secretariat at the centre to make it really effective. So, yes, but you wouldn't expect me to tell you exactly who we've been talking to. Louise, can I pass over to you?
Yes, OK. So I'll steer clear of who you've talked to. To Mr. Glenn, your question about, I think it's really, I've worked for and worked with many frustrated ministers over the years, and I think one of the things which I find, I think we have to troubleshoot this. Sorry, it's not good enough where we are. I think the civil service is too resistant to change. It was when I was there. And I think it's probably now much more resistant because of actually the way, frankly, it's been treated, which means people batten down the hatches. It's just a human thing. Sorry, you may not feel that you do that. I'm making a general comment and, you know, that may not feel fair. But certainly I feel, I believe, and the what I understand is that people have battened down the hatches and are waiting for change. And that's never healthy. And that's actually quite political as well. And you're not a civil servant to wait out something. You're there to execute, whether you agree with it or disagree with it, what ministers want. Though, having said that, I have in recent years watched people being bawled out and thought to myself, I don't think that would have happened before. Mm. And I also think we have a weaker civil service that isn't able to stand up for what is the right mode of behaving. And I think that more generally, though, let's face it, in society, we've got a bit of a fractured society going on at the moment where essentially a lot of people aren't playing by the rules of politeness and dignity. And I think that's one of our biggest issues, that we seem incapable of having disagreement in all sorts of circumstances without actually being able to do it properly and with respect to each other. On the expertise thing, I think it's a really it's partly about a modern civil service for the 21st century. And in many ways, I feel a lot of what we're dealing with at the moment in terms of our institutions and in terms of many of the things were set up in the 50 years at for the 20th century. Let's talk policing for a moment because I happen to know about that pretty well at the moment. And I think to myself, are all of these institutions going to be what we need as we head into the second quarter of the 21st century? And I think the answer to me is no. And so there has to be something here that means Gordon isn't, you know, the bloody prime minister, and he seems to find the only way he can bring people in is by putting them in the House of Lords. God knows we've got to sort that end out of the House of Lords. At the same time, the civil service don't need to be threatened by some of their expertise, but the people coming in need to know what their brief is, where they fit in and what their role is. And if they don't want that, including what promises are made, because obviously one, you want a name coming in, and I've never been a name in that way, but say you want to go and get some quasi-celebrity, over-promising them and not giving them what they want does go on, and they get really frustrated and ends up in tears. Just my last point, and I happen to agree that I agree that a lot of this, as I said at the beginning, is about effectiveness and a bit of running down, as we've had, of public service in life has not been a healthy phenomena across the board. So public servants on the whole get up in the morning trying to make the world a slightly better place, and our constant denigration of them isn't helping. But I think I do think there is a role for somebody either working to the cabinet secretary to actually brigade the civil service and reform it. I don't think it's something that currently is possible. Whether they need to report into a different minister or whether you have the sort of quasi, God rest his soul, Bob Kerslake, Jeremy Hayward, the combination there was that Bob didn't. Who was Bob? He wasn't a civil servant. So he didn't know about the civil service, so he wasn't necessarily the right person for the job, being blunt. And secondly, was he reporting into Jeremy, and was it Jeremy's responsibility for that change? No. So what was going on? So I think what you have there isn't necessarily... It might be a befuddled structure that means the civil service doesn't really know where it is in it all. And then finally, my last thing just to say is, like, you know, out there, we've got three totemic issues. Getting old social care, housing. It's like housing. And on top of it, immigration. And I can't, you know, and of course I'm concerned about homelessness, destitution, unemployment, growth of food banks, all of the things that Moira Wallace and her colleagues were set up to try and look at in different ways all those years ago on social exclusion. But I think we've got these totemic huge issues that we don't have a plan for, and we have road, streets, rail structures that are not fit for purpose, and ministers that don't at the moment really have a fit-for-purpose way for us taking it all forward, then that's not a political comment on this particular government, actually. It's just where I think we are in the cycle of things, and we've got to sort it.
We have to sort it.
Yes. I would just say, picking up on the delivery challenges and the bringing people in and out of the civil service, that I think movement back and forwards is really important. And we need to make that easier.
Yes.
I think the answer is by Ronaldo. It's not the answer, right? That's the problem. You always get, we want a name, and like, that doesn't work, right? Because they don't know how to operate inside. They're not really trying to. So I think that's that. The point about delivery challenges, I think it's a really, really important one. Because, you know, now I spend more of my time in private sector, you know, being paid by people far more than I ever was in the civil service. But, oh, my God, it's easy to do stuff, right? I have bosses who've known everything about the business, and I can talk to them about things. And it's like, oh, this is so straightforward.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, my previous work was as Gordon said, at times it's like going through treacle.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be. But sometimes you get people who want you to deliver stuff without the resources. They want you to, you know... Talking to a guy from retail, and I said, well, what would you do if you were required to sell everything for free, i.e. the NHS? It's a bit different as a challenge, right? It's not, your private sector skills don't necessarily... So I think we need to understand about delivery challenges that the public's expectation, you're absolutely right, of what you can do. So they want their shopping in 10 minutes, you know. They want to be able to do stuff. They want services that are up there. And for public sector to deliver those, at, you know, without the resources, it's never going to happen. So we need to think about ways of how do we solve that problem. And I think it's a really important one. And I think the civil service would love to have more ability to do this. And the one thing I would say about the system is, which isn't mentioned so much in the report, is we have a lot of what I call ex post mechanisms. The National Audit Office, we're really good at deciding when everything's gone terribly badly, right? I don't want that. I want to do it ex ante. Yeah. I want to actually have some policy processes that say, let's look at this thing called HS2. What's it going to do? What's the cost benefit look like? How's it going to deliver? When you look at the nuclear program, the SMRs, and all, okay, let's work out the price. Does that really make sense in this world with all the technology? You know, and then have the ex ante case, and then you can follow through the progress. We've got it in the Climate Change Committee. Can we have other things like that which monitor?
Anthony, final word.
In less than 1 minute, we've already overshot hugely. So much one could say, but just 2 points. This is a really important moment in history. This is a moment that we can get it right. Yes, we disagree. But look who's contributed to this. Look at the eminence of the people in this country and abroad who have contributed with deep experience and thought of the private sector and public sector. Look at the fact that we have two eminent prime ministers who've spoken to us today. Do you know how rare it is to have thoughtful post-prime ministers contributing to the public discussion? It hasn't happened in history. It is very rare. This is an indication, and we are blessed to have them. This is an indication of how important this report is. And yes, for those of you who think that the structures that we have at the moment are somehow the products of deep cogitation and thought, rubbish, rubbish, rubbish. The structures we have at the moment are the result of capricious, ill-considered, unevidence-based decisions. Units come and go. This is a thoughtful report. No, we haven't got everything right, but if we lose the opportunity this autumn to rethink and remodel a slimmer, smarter, slicker centre, everyone will lose. We can't lose that opportunity. Hannah.
Thank you, Anthony. On behalf of Anthony and myself, can I extend, firstly, our very great thanks to Sir John and Gordon for being with us today, to Baroness Casey and Lord O'Donnell for their very thoughtful remarks, kicking off just the sort of debate we hoped to with this report. I want to say a huge thank you to our commissioners. As I say, some of them are here. They gave a tremendous amount to us over the course of the year. We couldn't have done it without them. So thank you very much to them. Thank you to everyone who gave up their time to talk to us and give us their thoughts here and internationally. Thank you to my amazing team who have worked their socks off producing this report. They have done a brilliant job. Video and sound recording of this event will be available on our website shortly, so you can watch it back at your leisure. And you will also find there the full final report, which we've been discussing. So it just remains for me to thank you again for coming today. Thank you.